make one contribution to the to this week's focused discussion on code development. I'm very happy that David is here to answer all the difficult questions about the function. So I will say something about our implementation of bundles. Functional. I know that this has been discussed earlier during the program. So very quickly, what we have done in this area is to take the ideas developed by David and Bengt and others and try to see if we can make this computationally efficient and useful, including self-consistence. So this is the famous Langrath-Lundquist expression for the non-local correlation energy, which we want to evaluate. And then we basically adopted a kind of a real space approach with the idea of making a portable subroutine, which you could then take from one program to another, which basically uses just the one electron density as the input. Of course, if you just try to do this six-dimensional integral in sort of a brute force method in real space, for example, introducing a Cartesian grid, you would have n squared complexity. It's kind of expensive to do it, at least in a self-consistent way. So what we have been doing is to simply take a sort of idea from well-known idea from quantum chemistry to do one of these integrals in spherical coordinates and the other one in Cartesian. So this a couple of slides of this with a bit more detail, looking also into this kernel, which can be very conveniently expressed in terms of these dimensionless variables, capital D and capital delta, which depend on the local wave vector. So that was the expression for the energy, and now you can take the derivatives with this notation. It's a little bit hairy algebra, but you can do it, and this is now the expression to obtain the potential for self-consistent calculation. And both of these we calculate numerically using this real space technique. So this is the sketch of the kernel, and we do, as I said, quadrature on a combined Cartesian spherical grid. And the angular integral is done using what is known as the Lebedev grid, which is basically just spherical harmonics based grid. And then you do the real space grid using an adaptive grid, not a uniform grid, but a grid whose density, point density, is adjusted according to the local density. And obviously, the largest contribution to this integral comes from where the density is largest, so you use more points there and fewer points in the area where the density is low. So this is the adaptive approach that we have written into this code. Radial points are sort of a logarithmic mesh on the radial integral, and then Lebedev angular integration on the spherical. So this is nothing really very fancy, but just to make it work. And this really enables you to scale down enormously the number of points that are required for a given accuracy of this integral. So this is a cartoon which is supposed to give you an idea of how dense a point mesh you would need I think this was for an Oppenheimer calculation to receive, give an accuracy, a numerical accuracy in the interaction energy. So if you use just a non-adaptive grid, you need a lot of points to make sure that the integral is fully converged. If you adapt only the radial grid, you need fewer, still quite a few, and then the fully adaptive grid, actually, you can make this fairly fast and okay. And now, so this is now been implemented, and we have implemented it into several codes. We started writing this to as a subroutine to Siesta, and I know, of course, that there are other implementations, and I think you have, and of course David has, and many others. But the routine is, as I said, it's portable, and we're happy to share it with anybody who wants to try with their codes. We've also now implemented this, and it's part of the standard package of the so-called G4 software, which I will say a few words about later. But I thought I might be interested to spend a couple of minutes on these numbers also. So what we did first was to look at the S22 system of molecules and calculate Van der Waals energy for these systems. This is a table from our recent paper where we use two descriptions of the exchange, red BBE and BBE, and then compare our results to the industry standard, so to speak, the couple cluster calculations. And you see the agreement, of course, it is not perfect, but it's not so bad either, at least from a physicist's point of view. But what was more interesting is perhaps is that it depends quite a lot on which recipe you choose for the exchange. There's a notable difference between red BBE and BBE. In this set of molecules, you have different types of bonds, hydrogen bonded, dispersion bonded, and mixed bonded. Again, here we show this comparison for this, divided now into these different types of bonds, and you'll see that there are, especially with hydrogen bonded molecules, some serious differences between the two groups. Angelos Michaelides has recently done similar work using actually the G4 code where this has been implemented. Has Google taken the story a little bit further by trying all kinds of exchange descriptions, we can argue and discuss whether he's really trying to correct the right thing or not, but has played around with different types of flavors of BBE, GGA type functionals for both exchange.
Can I ask a question? This adaptive scheme that you have based on the density, you're just using that for the energy calculation?
These are all self-consistent calculations.
I wonder if you are using that you have less grid points for calculating the potential.
Yes.
Because, for example, the BA86 and the AN05, we have seen that they communicate a huge exchange correlation potential out in the vacuum where you have very low density, and you are very prone to numerical errors for those.
Oh, I see. You mean talk about possible divergences?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, we are aware of those, but those are not, we have taken care of those. So they have been, if you may believe me,
when you do AN05 calculations in BASC, you sometimes have problems just because of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gets so numerically unstable that it's
I don't think this is reflected here.
Okay. No, I'm not in this table, but I was, since you were going away from that topic, I wanted to ask you.
So this is Angelos' MAD data. That means mean absolute deviations for the S22 set.
I have a question about those. Optimizing geometry for those calculations?
I understand that, yes. Because we did this rep BBE and BBE, and there we our results basically agree, and we did the full optimization. These are the mean absolute deviations in this set of molecules, and they are divided now to hydrogen bonded, dispersion bonded, and mixed bonded, and then this range spans the it's the difference between the smallest and the largest value. So typically in this red BBE BBE calculations, 65 was the mean absolute deviation that was given by the Langer-Lundquist formula, and then Angelos with twisting a little bit the parameters in BBE, for example, can push this down to 21 or perhaps even below. So this, I don't know if this is physics or chemistry, but anyway, this is what has been done. And the aim, of course, is to try to come up with a technique which is not much computationally expensive than doing regular GGA BBE type calculation, and where you would reach into this millivolt.
What is the range there?
It's the difference between the smallest and the largest deviations from the reference. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say. And again, this is Angelos' plot from the same data. Now, his best functional, if you so believe, is this red curve which shows now the best agreement with the CDR couple cluster data. I don't know if this has been published, but I got this.
What was the best of BKX6?
I think it's this BBE where kappa has been put equal to 1.
Okay. Well, actually, I see now the green and the red are essentially the same, right?
That's right, yes.
Well, yeah.
I will have to look at the Angelos.
That's right. It's the blue one. I think his message was the optimized BKX8.
Yeah.
Yes. This is the blue one.
But it looks like the optimization has been to minimize the error, right?
Sure.
Okay.
That's
what
it is.
But this is now implemented, and of course people can play around with this quite nicely. Okay, I just want to mention that this is kind of a fast discalculation. We are interested in real application, and the biggest application which we have tried so far is to look at the diffusion of this large molecule on potassium bromide. Chromite surface. I will not go into any details. We have mapped this potential energy surface for diffusion, and in this system, van der Waals is important in understanding the area and the mobility of these molecules along flat surfaces and across step edges and so on. So this is a serious surface physics calculation where system sizes are well over 200 atoms, and the van der Waals is implemented there now in a self-consistent fashion. This data we have recently published also. Okay, so I mentioned this, it's in the Siesta. There are two implementations actually with Siesta, and then I want to spend the last minute in advertising this GPO real space code. There's a wiki. There's a website where everything is explained. I will not go into detail. I will just mention that this is a project that we have been working on together with a group in Copenhagen for many years. And the idea was to implement PAW construction using a real space tree. And that has been done with various kinds of bells and whistles added recently. And now also there's an alternative basis set which you can use atom-centered localized basis set. It's also possible. So, and it now consists also this, contains also the Wondermouse package. So I want to advertise this because it's, we believe it's a very nice code, not perhaps very widely known, but it's picking up, and since we put it on the website a couple of years ago, now we see a doubling time of people, of publications citing G-Paul, doubling every 200 days or so. So why am I advertising is this? Because of the real space nature, this program is very flexible as comes to boundary conditions. So you can use periodic boundary conditions, pre-boundary conditions, any combination of these, which makes it especially nice for nanostructures or systems with low in internal intrinsic symmetry. Okay, and on the website you will find many references to these recent papers. For example, there is a time dependence now implemented where you can also do time-dependent DFT either in the hydropropagation or linear response mode. And I already mentioned these Wondermouse features. So if you're interested, you can visit the website and learn much more there. Okay, this was my 10 minutes, maybe a little bit.
Thank you.
So can you just compare your Wondermouse longest implementation with what Solaire is doing with respect to efficiency?
Yeah, I tried to do that, but I cannot really answer. I think they have this fast multiple moment type of expansion, and it seems to me to be also very efficient.
I mean, apparently both is now in Siesta, right?
Yes. Both are using Siesta.
Both are in G-Paul too.
First,
both are in G-Paul.
Yes, both are in G-Paul too. Yes, yeah. So we will have to do a real runoff between these two methods. I cannot say. I think they are comparable. There is not an order of magnitude difference, but which one scales better and so on. I really don't know.
Yeah, but if you do a GGA calculation and compare it with Vanderbilt's calculation, can you measure the difference, say, for
that's right,
a 50 atom system or 100 atom system?
Yeah, probably not.
Is there any difference? You can't measure it, right? So
yeah.
You can't measure it with a Solaire algorithm either, so
yeah.
It doesn't really matter which one is faster, right, if you're talking about it.
And accuracy, actually, that's what I'm saying, speed and accuracy, right? So that is the same thing.
I would say the same thing, and you can really control this accuracy because of this, at least in this grid technique, it's very easy to control this numerical accuracy.
Maybe
well, I was just going to point out some of these things, but about the Solaire algorithm that have already come out, so. But I do want to, we'll have to talk about the numbers
sometime, okay,
because
so we
don't agree with someone. So.
Another question. Can you say a word about the grid adaptation and the time propagation things? Do you adapt the grid as you propagate in time?
No. I mean, okay. The grid adaptation is only in this Wondermouse part. Full G-Paul, time-dependent G-Paul, we don't have this adaptation yet. So there it's a fixed grid that we use. Or actually now you also have the option to do it in finite elements. That's also part of the package now. It's another nice feature in this real space code that you can take this technology which was developed in the engineering community and actually in finite elements you can do it. But you have the problem, of course, that you need to create a very clever grids. So just a regular cubic degrees is too steep.
How do you compute gradients with an adaptive grid? I would imagine that derivatives of grid weights that are adaptive are pretty difficult to take.
You mean numerical?
Well, if you said if these were optimized structures, so you somehow have to compute gradients of your energy with respect to nuclear positions, right? When you optimize the structure. Right? I mean, how do you optimize geometries in your code?
Well, I mean, just the nuclear relaxation is done just in the standard way. We just have an additional piece in the energy and in the potential, which are included exactly as you would do in a normal DFT calculation.
Yes, and then the problem arises that you're that your grid weights can be structure dependent, depending on how you construct your grids. So if you have atom-centered grids, for example, they are generally structure-dependent. Is there any structure dependence in the grids that you use? Like, do they change as, I would think they would change if it's adaptive, right? As your structure changes.
I'm not sure if I understand the question, because I mean, well, you do your DFT calculation using whatever basis set or grid you want, and you get the density that you need to put in, plug in.
Oh,
and then
you do a Helmholtz final table.
Right.
Okay, but that means that potentially, depending on how you construct your grids, you're not getting the exact analytical derivative of your energy. Because if the weights, the grid weights, the grid points are structure dependent, then the quality of your quadrature will vary with the structure.
This is probably a relatively dense adaptation, right? I mean, you're basically, what is the, I think the question boils down to what is the adaptation criterion that you use? I mean, do you adapt to 1 or 2 millielectron volts or to somewhere, well, close to numerically exact? Because if you had an adaptation of the grid that left you with a noise of a few millielectron volts or so, then this noise would enter the trajectory of your compensation. But of course, if you do a.
Oh, but we're talking about these fundamental systems here, right? So, millielectron volt can be a lot. Right?
I think it would be much more optimized.
Yeah,
probably it is. That's right. I think Parker's. What it makes it so it's really making sure that you have full control of this numerical noise or full attack corrections that you would have because of the grids changing. So, but that's something which I try to indicate with these funny looking maps of the grid point density that you need to use to satisfy the criteria, the numerical stability criteria.
I mean, the alternative is to construct grids in a way that you get smooth potential energy surfaces, right?
Yeah. So I'd like to ask more about the adaptation process. So you start with a grid that's not optimal and you adapt it to optimize it. So it's an iterative process, right?
Well,
or how do you get the optimal grid?
Well, it's a kind of a learning process. I mean, pretty quickly you gain experience on what type of a grid density and structure you need to achieve the accuracy that you request. So you actually want to minimize the number of adaptive steps that you take. So you start something which you believe is affordable, but it's already reasonably accurate. And then during the minimization, you can then put more grid points, make it denser, and to satisfy yourself of convergence. So this is not built into any kind of automatic loop of the calculation that it, which would be, it's done heuristically, if you like. It's not really adaptive grid in the sense that it would automatically find its desired value. So you have to adjust it, and you have to control the numerical stability.
This is a per-atom grid, right? I mean,
sorry?
The per-atom grid.
Per-atom grid.
So this is just normal, yeah, limited.
That's right.
Angle, of course.
Yes. Okay.
It doesn't change throughout the calculation.
This is...
I mean, if you have the same atom, you have the same grid, right?
But does it evolve during the calculation?
Well, you can make it evolve, but usually there's not too much reason to make it evolve.
If you fix it, then you have a cool
effect.
Yeah,
you can
do
it. I mean, it's like me.
But
what?
Yes, I mean, I was expecting this question. And yes, we have, because I mean, one system that we actually was among the first that we were interested in, that's why we came into using this function, and was looking at benzene molecules on silicon and silica, and also benzene on aluminium and aluminum. And there has been this long controversy about the adsorption geometry, butterfly versus other possible geometries. And there we make the claim that actually self-consistency is important if you want to get the correct structure. So there are some examples, I believe, where you really have to go all the way to do it self-consistent.
Okay. No more questions? Thanks again. I mean, actually, our original idea was to compare different codes and to let people talk about the best of the codes. Unfortunately, all our two-dimensional codes not dropped out somehow, because one of our speakers, Matteo Santamassi, got sick, and the other one, Paolo, had to leave earlier, so we ended up with two contributions from all the different codes. Do you want to start?
I mean, let's start using two of the
Here we are. Okay. So I guess we can rephrase it by stating that the best codes here by definition are all electron codes. Anyway. So this is my quick contribution. I call it FHIMs in a nutshell. And this is, as you know, an all-electron density functional theory and beyond code, I call it here, with numeric atom-centered basis functions. So this is a code that we've been working on in Berlin for the past 5 years or so. It's a general purpose all-electron code, but a lot of the emphasis has gone into making it scalable towards large systems, and by large, at this point, we mean systems of up to thousands of CPUs for which electronic structure problems are actually usually relevant, some thousands of atoms, I'm sorry, and also computer systems that can reach up to thousands of CPUs, because this is the hardware that we have available. The presentation here really is only hopefully 10 minutes, so it's only going to be an overview of certain points, and you're welcome to ask more. And it's also kind of a teaser for things that Xingu is going to talk about tomorrow, because he's going into the beyond LDA DJ business tomorrow. How we do that. And I'm going to say a few words on Wednesday. I think if that's still the current program on scalability and specifically what we've done with respect to the eigensolver. But to clear up one thing, so this FHIAM stands for the Fritz Haber Institute. That would be Matthias's our group. Have initial molecular simulations package. And a lot of people have contributed, not just the people that are listed here on the basic publication that is now out on the numerical techniques used in there, but probably at least 10 people at this point beyond that group listed here. If I have time, I'll say that in the end. So since this is an overview, one of the things I wanted to state, although some of you may have seen this already, is why we're actually interested in, we were interested in writing in the electron structure code because of the range of problems that we have. If you phrase this as a wish list, if you're interested in molecules, biochemical systems, etc., you usually are interested in having something that deals with first row and then second row elements efficiently, but then there's the whole rest of chemistry and also physics that you'd like to deal with efficiently. In Berlin, that's the 3D transition metals and the Mach systems, or 4D and 5D transition metals for catalysis, so that's relativity. And then there are all the sort of more open questions in the field. The one example that's listed here is F electron chemistry, which we're not doing at this point, but this is firmly on the radar from, as you can see, from Mommer's contributions and Patrick's here and others. And then there are some technical points, such as the simple fact that we'd also like to deal with periodic and cluster type systems on equal footing. And that is, although almost trivial, really an annoying issue because historically most methods are either grounded in the periodic world and have difficulties with cluster type systems or vice versa. That is something we wanted to overcome from the ground up at this point. And then we'd like this code to be all electron if we can, and that was one goal. And the philosophy behind all this was to try and get this into a framework that is efficient computationally, of course, but not efficient to the point of sacrificing accuracy. So even though we want to be efficient in our calculations, we'd always like to have a path back that allows us to converge any numerical approximation in the code. Of course, converging the exchange correlation functional itself is more difficult, but Matthias has been doing that for a while, I guess, in cluster correction schemes. But that's what we'd like to do. The prescription in a nutshell that we settled for to do all this, because we had prior good experiences with that in the department actually before I joined, is numeric atom centered basis functions as a basis set. That really is the central choice in the code, because of course that determines all the algorithms that you're going to use in the following. They have this simple shape, and probably most of you have seen this. These are used in codes like FFLOW or DMOL cubed and similar, so we didn't invent them. But they're very useful. They consist of a normal YLF function for the angular momentum product of the atom, and then this radial function here is fully flexible in its shape. So basically, it could be anything you like. That flexibility is what allows us to generate basis sets, then, which are as compact as possible, remote while remaining transferable between different systems. So in a nutshell, what we're aiming for here is written here in the sketch line. But that is really true. We'd like the speed of plane wave pseudopotential methods, but hopefully at an accuracy that is LAPW-like, which is still, at least in the solid state world, the gold standard that we have. This is naturally all electron because we can use as sort of a minimal basis the radial functions of free atoms, at least in the basic functional theory at the outset. And this gives us a very good description of the core already from there. But then we can also increase the number of basis functions systematically. We've spent quite some work constructing hierarchical basis sets for basically all elements that matter, so elements 1 to 100. So starting from this minimal basis prescription of just free atoms, which are actually never really useful in production, I would argue, but up to very large basis sets that allow you million electron volt converged total energies. This prescription has been shown by many groups in the past to handle periodic and cluster systems really on equal footing as we'd like that. FFLOW is historically a periodic flow. DMOQ is historic cluster, and really the same. I mean, we can do it too, in other words. We have a code here at this point that is useful both on a single CPU, but then also up to massively parallel systems, such as a BlueJean with maybe up to 10,000 CPUs or so in a single run. And then the stuff that I'm not going to talk about, but that was important to us to have at the outset, is the fact that this doesn't only work in DFT, LDA, GGA, but we were able to go beyond that and then include the two-electron operator, and that gives us access to what we thought hybrid functionals, or quantum chemical perturbation theory, such as MP2 or RPA, and some of those results have shown up here before, and also self-energy methods, MGW and MP2, and this is, at this point, ongoing work, but we're actually pretty happy that we have a description there that works. Jingwu is going to say more about that. I'd just like to highlight two more aspects of these radial functions in a very brief way. First of all, the fact that we can choose this shape here flexibly allows us to basically have these radial functions go smoothly to zero. This is trivial in a sense. We use a cutoff potential in a Schrodinger-like equation to push this down. But of course, this is very important for scaling and also gives us order n scalability for the most expensive numerical operations. So this can basically be used to cut off trailing zeros outside a certain given cutoff radius for these basis functions. And the second thing is, of course, that a lot of this work is done in real space on grids, on the same grids that we've just seen, overlapping atom-centered radial grids with limited points on them. But by nicely splitting these points up into batches of points, so these black dots are here are the actual grids. The red boxes are what the code actually sees during the computation. That means that that you can reformulate density updating integrations, of course, both of them. But also makes these grid-based operations parallelize very well because you can distribute them out to different CPUs without much communication. I think I'll say a few words here on the accuracy of the basis sets. You're welcome to ask me about the basis sets in more detail later on. Here I'll just introduce the hierarchy that we typically use. We can start from a minimal basis sets, then we can add a few radial functions to what we call tier one, because these are the first tier or most important radial functions. Then comes the second tier of basis functions and a third tier as you go to convergence. And this is just for the hydrogen bond energy in a water diagram, mainly for the purpose that this is not what our basis functions were constructed for, but a very different type of bond than what we actually use in the construction of these basis sets. Still, you can see that the convergence is relatively fast. The minimal basis is way away from the convergence out. But already this relatively small tier one basis that there will be the six atoms and 50 basis functions or something that in the West here gets us there to within 10%. It gets the geometry almost right. If you want to become pretty much accurate to the few millivolt volt level, then you can go to this tier two. And in standard density functional theory, that is DFT, LDA, GGA, that is typically what we encounter with these basis sets. So this works very well. The other thing, yes?
What is the binding energy of the diamond on that scale?
Oh, sorry, it's this one. This is the actual basis set limit, so this is the binding energy of the water diamond.
Or it's
something, electron volts. In dBE, of course. So, Hiram was right from this way. This is actually a pretty good number for the water diamond.
Any other side of this?
Yeah. So, I will say a few words about the scalability that we have at this point, just to outline the kind of work we've done. This relatively busy plot here is for a simple structure that just demonstrates the thing that we have. It's a fully extended polyalanine peptide, polyalanine because there are these nice CH3 groups here and the peptide backbone is here, with up to 1,000 atoms in the structure, and the total CPU time on, I think, 8 CPUs, this is called 5 CPUs. When it's the CF iteration, it's this black line that goes up somehow. The important part is that the initially most expensive things, charge density update and Hamiltonian, really go as order n from a reasonable value on. The electrostatic potential could be made order n, we just haven't done this here, but for example, in periodic systems, this comes naturally through the EVO construction. We need something similar in the cluster case. And then finally, at some point, this determines this of thousands of atoms. We use a conventional eigensolver, and that crosses over as order n to the 3 in the limit, or at least that's what it should do.
So what is white, red, and blue better than linear?
Again?
Red and blue is even better than linear scale.
Not exactly. I think this is more of the fact here that we switch on fact matrices in this case in memory. So inside the Hamiltonian integration, packing and unpacking matrices for a little bit of time, that gives that here, I believe. Yes.
You get similar results with an object which is not white and one dimension.
Similar, yes, except for the scaling limit comes much later. This is basically, the purpose of this plot is not to say this is how it always is. The purpose of this plot is to say this is the limit that we can achieve. This is why it's a linear structure. We can make it a little bit less linear and also set all the settings to tight. By tight, I really mean that this basically converges the quantities you're interested in. Everything goes up, but the qualitative picture more or less remains the same, and then you can of course, argue how tight should tight be and what you put in those settings, but that's what it is. And the other thing I'd like to point out, I'm going to say more about that on Wednesday, is the fact that we do use a conventional ISO over here, originally based on the ScalarPack library. And this is actually a feature of these methods, of course, because you have a relatively small basis set compared to the grid-based operations. So you can get away with basically the most robust type of eigensolvers to up to relatively large system sizes into these hundreds to thousands of atoms. Of course, the order n scaling at some point becomes relevant, but we'd have to invest into truly linear scaling methods, say, up here. But at least for most household type systems, this really is a viable strategy, except that there's the question of parallel scaling. So if you run on this Lugin here, of course, we still have to have an eigensolver that scales. Now, what I'm showing here is a computation time of a tight calculation of a 1,000 atom peptide in a helical structure. The point is that if you plot the elapsed time as a function of the number of CPUs used here, you see that this deviates from linear scaling quite badly. This is what typically you expect from something like library-based eigensolvers, at least the literature is full of results of that sort. ScalarPack for this matrix dimension, which is 27,000, gives out at about 1,000 CPUs in this case. And a lot of the work in detail that we do is actually trying to overcome such bottlenecks. In this case, we have a collaborative project with the Compute Center of the Max Planck Society in Garching and various other partners. But it turns out in that project, simply rewriting the algorithms that are used in ScalarPack with a lot more attention to details in there gives you much better scaling already, so up to 4,000 CPUs in this case. So this kind of thing can be overcome if you put the work in, and we hope to continue there. And the end of my talk is actually just things that we can do with it, such as something that Alex Kachenko has already shown you, like ab initio molecular dynamics for structures of the size of 180 atoms with 20 picoseconds. This here was to compare the unfolding dynamics of this peptide with and without van der Waals interactions, and you can really see the differences and the importance of van der Waals in real life. This one goes and becomes big and goes outside the borders here very fast, whereas this one gives up its helical structure but more or less stays compact. So the conformational energy landscape really visibly changes if you run such simulations. And we hope that this energy landscape here is really accurate enough at this point to make meaningful statements for the bio community also in folding processes such as this. And of course, this works across the periodic table, but I think I'll stop at this point because I'm over my 10 minutes. Thanks. Going to be Shingu's talk tomorrow. To a large extent, so I'm not going to take away too much from, or I can't take away too much from what he'll say because I don't have much. It's resolution of the identity with a auxiliary basis set that is constructed from the on-site part of the original numeric basis set. If that recipe works remarkably well. This was originally just a fix to get a quick result, but so far this fix has stayed with us.
But you still don't get linear scaling from that.
True. So if you want to do linear scaling, happy fuck, as far as I know. I'm not sure whether this is formally proven, but my understanding is linear scaling, happy fuck, the resolution of the identity will not be possible. I'd like to state, though, that getting resolution of the identity and those methods to work with these basis sets is already a success. Because originally, when we started, the literature basically said, you do this with Gaussians and you don't bother with numeric Adam-centered orbitals. And the fact that it actually worked is, at this point, rather encouraging. We'll see whether we can actually go back and get something like linear scaling after all, but everyone knows that.
Well, I wouldn't see how that would work, but okay. So what do you use for the auxiliary expansion?
Basically, products of on-site basis functions.
Okay, this, and these are still numerical, and so you reduce everything to integrals over electrostatic integrals of the two basis functions.
More or less, sir.
In order to construct these variable functions, I got the impression from what you said you do it by integrating a Schrodinger equation in some potential. Is that how you get it?
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit how you get it?
So essentially, we could use anything we like for our radial functions, but in practice, we want something that is physically sanely behaved. So we use a radial Schrodinger equation, as you say. And that has two important parts. One is the sort of basis defining potential. So this is not the self-consistent potential of the calculation. It just serves to define this radial function back here. And that could be anything. So a free atom-like potential, which some people in the literature have advocated, hydrogen-like potentials, which would give you essentially slave type orbital, free ions, which Deli has advocated heavily in the EMOL code. You could even use a harmonic oscillator if you want to get Gaussian. And the second part is the cutoff potential here. And this is really where the Schrodinger equation is convenient, because you can use this cutoff potential. And this onset here of the cutoff potential typically happens at many 4 angstroms. So this is not a tight constraint, but it's still important to push down those zeros at this point. In practice, it turns out that hydrogen-like functions are mostly what falls out of our basis construction strategy. I can say more about that. Do it necessary, but in practice, it turns out that Slater actually the old early quantum mechanics set right there. Mostly these here beat, if you try a big pool of radial functions and see what works best, mostly these here beat all the other options. Although the ionic functions sometimes make a difference. Yeah.
You talked about relativity on the wish list.
Yeah. So relativity, in short, here is scalar relativity. So what we have at this point,
Harman curling.
Say again?
Harman curling.
Yeah, Harman curling would be nice, but that becomes state dependent, of course.
Yeah.
The expression in curling Harman is state dependent. So in short, what we started out with is, let me go there.
That's right here, I think.
We this is a longer resistive equation, so that's not what we want to start out with. We can solve the Dirac equation also, but in four components we don't do that, essentially because we'd like to keep the scalar relativity. And then here is Harman curling, and the problem is the energy dependence down here. So this doesn't work outright, because obviously you have to solve a Hamiltonian now for every single state, and we don't want to do this for the full Hamiltonian. So the simplest way around is to use this Zora approximation, which was advocated in Lawrence and Co., which says we don't like this. Well, they have a more complicated argument, but I put it as we don't like these things, so let's make it go away. So this, of course, is not a fabulous approximation, as people know. So if you do this with Zora, then things like non-relativistic versus relativistic binding curves change quite a lot. We are actually intending to go a little bit further than what we've had in the past. But at this point, we have two things that essentially solve the problem. The issue is that this here is originally dependent on E minus V. If you take the E out, then you lose gauge invariance. So you might just as well use a potential down here that doesn't change your self-consistent cycle, so then you keep gauge invariance but by definition, and all is nice. So this is what we call atomic Zora. This actually works relatively nicely in relaxations, because you get simple energy gradient. The other thing suggested by the Lawrence group early on is something that something called scale Zora, which essentially rescales certain terms here exactly. So this here is kind of a geometric series down there. Now, we had this originally because we wanted to go on and still want to go on to something that is more Harman-Curling-like. It turns out, though, that if you use mean to K for a bunch of benchmark systems, this is the gold diamond, but we've done this for a variety of systems in between. Binding curves, already from the simplified atomic Zora prescription and then mean to K, which has a full Dirac core, and then proper scalar relativity in the variance, that works remarkably well. And the scale Zora curve that I'm showing here is right up top. Now, you can, of course, still go on, so I'm just going to think through here. What we've done to continue is to actually go and undo the Zora approximation for the deep core states and solve these using just on-site basis functions with a fixed numerically stable term down here and treat the remaining valence type states where this E is small in this case Zora. That also works very well.
And
but
NAO?
Yeah.
NAO, what is that?
Numeric atom-centered basis orbit, sorry.
Yeah.
This also works, and this is ongoing work.
So what do you call
in a nutshell?
Kelling-Harmon, what do you call it?
Kelling-Harmon is scalar relativity.
Scalar relativity.
But scalar relativity for me is anything that is one component or a, yeah, I think
this is one component. Do you have spin orbit coupling?
Not yet. This is something heavy duty on the list.
Yeah.
Should be done.
Can you say a few words about the Dirac implementation?
So I just want to introduce the exciting code to you, so to give you a brief overview of what exciting is. It's actually freely available code. It's licensed under the GPL license, and it's an implementation of the full potential linear instrument plane, FPL-EPW in SM. What I call the gold standard. Okay. So what is the basics of the LFPW method that we make use of this pointer? The partitioning of the unit cell. So around the atomic positions, we have the so-called atomic spheres, like alpha and beta, and everything else is called the partition regions. And whatever we do, so we have a dual representation of basis function, dual function, and so on. That means we have atomic-like basis functions in the atomic spheres. This allows us to handle the strong oscillations of the electronic density of the potential close to the nucleus. Then we have a plane wave basis in the restriction and density, and the potential is only slowly varying. And well, actually it allows us to have it as an implementation of the all electron method, so we can explore the core region, we can treat all kinds of electronic states in the atoms, and that way we also can treat all kinds of atoms in the unit cell, also heavy elements itself in the further approximation. Well, what's the basis set? I introduce here the LAPW basis set. Actually, there are a variety of APW-like basis sets, starting from the APW method and kind of the linear estimated plane wave method, then the superlinear estimated plane wave methods, and so on and so forth. For simplicity, I just talk about the LAPW because it's the standard method which is most widely known. So mentioned already, we have this dual representation of the basis, which are the plane waves in the interstitial. This is what all the methods have in common. Whereas inside the spheres, we have a linear combination of radiant functions, which are centered around the atomic sphere alpha, times a spherically harmonic fixed pair of the angles here. So what we choose here, these ULs are the solutions of the radial Schrodinger equation inside the sphere. The UL dot is the energy derivative, and the ALM and the BLM coefficients are chosen later. So chosen such that the basis function is continuous in values and slope at the Mockenkier sphere. And the EL are the energy parameters, so these are not the actual solutions of the Schrodinger equation, of the Kronstrom equation, but they are parameters depending on the corresponding L state which we are going to treat. Well, what does it mean in terms of cost? Actually, LAPW is LAPW is quite costly, it's not as efficient as a method like James was on. Well, each plane wave which is coming in here, and let's assume this is the Mackintin sphere here, so each plane wave is really augmented by the linear combinations of the radial functions. And that means that the size of the basis is determined not by the radial functions inside the sphere, but the size is determined by the number of plane waves which we need to describe in this degree. And that's why it's relatively costly, because we need a lot of plane waves outside here. Anyway, if you choose a large Mockenkier sphere, and this is recommended in order to have it less costly, like this here, that means that everything, all these digits inside here at the atomic region, are taken care of by the radial functions, and only this very slowly varying density outside has to be described by plane waves. That means we don't need many plane waves to do so. So the larger the plane, the Mockenkier sphere, the smaller number of plane waves. If you have a small sphere here, like you have to use if you have short bonds or in materials under pressure, then of course you have to describe these wiggles by plane waves outside, and then the method becomes more costly. We can go, let's say, until touching spheres, but of course not overlapping spheres. And so somehow the proper choice, a clever choice of the Mockenkier spheres, determines the cost of the calculation. There are other so-called local orbitals, which are additional basis functions inside the sphere. And these local orbitals only live inside the sphere, so they're not augmented plane waves. And that means that they actually come without any cost, or with hardly any cost. And these are usually used to describe the so-called semi-core states. So these are states which cannot, well, they are not decayed to zero. The wave function is not zero outside the sphere, so we cannot use it as a treated as a dwarf state. But the local orbitals here helps us to have additional basis functions which take care of them. Okay, in our code, I mentioned already, so we have the LAPW implemented, we have super LAPW implemented, but also the so-called APW plus local orbital method. I'm not going into details here, but just mentioning this is even more efficient than LAPW because we need less basis functions to describe one and the same system, and this is set to the default value. A separate talk by Christian on Thursday, I think, about our implementation and funds. I'm not going to go into details here. Let me just mention one thing. Of course, we have two representations of basis functions, not only for the wave function, but also for the potential and for the density. And we have a Fourier series for the potential and density in the transition, and again, a representation in terms of lattice harmonics inside the spheres. And this, so to say, shows you that we are really dealing with a full potential method. So we can describe, we don't need the shape approximation for the potential, but this can describe the full potential here. Well, this also tells us somehow, or together with the representation of the wave function, we see that the simplicity of LAPW comes from the fact that whatever we do, we calculate wave functions, matrix elements, whatever, we have contributions either from inside the sphere or outside the sphere, but we don't have any contributions where we have mixed basis functions. So everything is simple in that sense that we either have to deal with the plane waves or with these lattice harmonic representations, but we never or hardly have any mixed. Okay. I mean, we had a lot of things implemented, like forces and geometry optimization and exact exchange and so on. But I just want to focus on one thing, which is our implementation on excited states. So we have both. We have the time-dependent BFD in the linear response regime implemented, as well as the BDSR beta equation to fit off with this vector. The advantage here is that we really can compare these two procedures with each other on the same footing, because all the matrix elements, the wave functions, the potential, the density, and so on, is treated on the same form with this numerical accuracy and this is the same data. This is our implementation of DDBFT. What we have implemented is a very kernel kernels, the PDLDA, and two long-range kernels which take care of exophonic effects, and also the many-body kernel which actually was derived from the beta equation. Just to show you one result, this is the optical spectra of gallium arsenide. On top we have the solution of the beta equation, and below we have the solution of the time-dependent BFD using different kernels, and you see that the gallium arsenide are basically on top of each other. Results. Okay, let me just show you what we are working on at the moment. One larger project is dealing with phonons, so we are currently implementing the response for phonons. As a consequence, we would like to fit thermodynamic properties. We're also working on the stress-strain relation, elastic constant. K dot B at LAPW is one idea to make the LAPW method less costly by introducing a new basis set which allows us to reduce the number of basis functions. It's the same, or hopefully the same accuracy as LAPW is. We're working on GW. We have an implementation already of the Van der Waals density functional, however not self-consistently. We are working on the interface to the divisor at the toolkit ATAP. We're also working on basically mentioned already there will be a talk, a short contribution by Christian on Thursday, so I'm not going to talk about our development strategy or communication with developers. Just want to provide you one more information, which is the website where you can download the code and where you can find all kinds of information for the implementer who is developing this code.
Yes, my question. Relativity. Do we have any relativity?
Yes, we have the general scheme is the scalar relativistic scheme. We have been over in the second derivation scheme. And we have it also implemented with spinors because scale surface change requires the spin up representation of it.
As you said, actually, we don't have too many people with two potentials. This is doing what we did.
We're producing code, so I mean.
Yes, but why are you doing all electron? Why is it important compared to the potential of GAW? Obviously, I know the answer, but yes.
I mean,
the
forecast has said so much about it. No, actually, we can deal with all kinds of atoms. We can go to heavier elements, and in particular, since we are focusing on excited states, we can do more excitation, which is also limited in solar potential. And you know, of course, as well as I know, that there are discrepancies between solar potential and other electron in terms of GW. We also see some discrepancies in the electron hole wave function in the Petersfeld data. I think it's just important to have a reference or a benchmark for other methods. I don't think GAW is
besides your code, the second famous GAW code is V2K. Mm-hmm. How do they compare in speed, in massive parallel, in accuracy, or whatever?
Accuracy should hopefully be the same. It's the same thing, it's the same big. In speed, I would say if you have a center of inversion, then exciting it stays lower because at the moment we don't make use of inversion symmetry, so we're working with complex matrices. I hope we will have a version soon which makes or gives us a real matrix, then they should be. Comparable,
it's scaling in parallel.
We have an MPI parallel version and also K parallel version, and Christian is working on some more fancy methods which are not yet finished. But
scaling is number of
atoms? I think it's the same like me. You have a N cube scaling, but
the best.
Okay, we used to use V2K, and now one of my best guys switched to excitement labs. So we all got excited. Now, when we check, for example, orthonormality of the brackets, because we don't use dual coefficients in exciting, he claims that they are much more accurate in V2K, like many more digits. Is this true, or do I have to trust him?
I mean, I don't know at the moment. We're right now, we have issued the first release. We are trying to test everything. So far, we didn't see any discrepancy.
I mean, it's much more elegant, not to use dual coefficients, but.
There are dual coefficients in the result.
But not in the.
I don't know which kind of particular piece of the code you're looking at.
Well, the brackets you have in the optical response.
The optical response we don't use. I don't know which version you're using. We have what we released now, which you can find here in the exciting code, is a completely new package which contains all the excitation spectra.
This is different from ELK?
This is different from ELK. This is the only difference. I mean, the code is the same. It was, the history is that it was developed in Graz when K.U.S. and Sangeeta Sharma were postdocs in my group. And at a certain point, I think this was half a year ago, we decided to split because we wanted to go in different directions, but it's basically the same.
But I gather it's
much more elegant.
The idea is really disastrous.
It's
not. I mean, it's accurate, but it's
historically wrong. The idea was to have a clean code where you really can try out new things, and if you're dealing with PTSR beta or W, whatever, it really gives you a lot of headache if you're reading the code, which was grown historically. Exciting is much, much easier to do.
You say you can adjust the size of the sphere, right? Can you run something like a TDDFT calculation with the FXC just inside the sphere and it's up to zero outside? So completely illegal. Have you ever tried to do that?
No.
That's interesting.
Connected to that same question, do you have the relativity? Is that in the interstitial region as well, or is it only in the competence?
I mean, as spin orbit, I mean, we're actually working on a version which is working everywhere, but the standard implementation is in this field.
Yes.
We're working on it.
Mike, can you talk a little tomorrow about how you do the
I mean, yes, Stefan is going to talk about the PTSR beta. Hong is going to talk about the GW and Beam, but we are actually porting the same thing.
So tomorrow?
This week. Yes, I think it's tomorrow because you said you're leaving.
LABW in general, or ABW, your basis functions are continuous in value and slope. Kinetic energy is the second derivative.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a problem sometimes?
No, I mean, you can do it the way that you let the NABLA operate on both sides, and you automatically have it continuous. If you don't do so, or if you need higher order derivatives, there are all these additional terms popping up, Fourier terms, which you have taken into account, and then you get exactly the same answer. There's no problem, so you have to think about it.
Maybe a related question. In practice, you use a beta LM component to expand it. Mm-hmm. So in practice, this will not be continuous. Right? I don't know. Only to start an accuracy.
I mean, we go up to L equal 10 in the spheres for the wave function and up to 6 for the potential typically, but we can go to higher values, and in some systems it turns out to be crucial. In most systems it probably doesn't, but you always have to check.
Even if I plot densities, right, then I'll
have
the sphere actually kinks at the,
yeah,
even in the density matches.
But does that impact the gradient function?
In some cases, we really have to go to higher values in order to get a great force.
It just looks ugly if you want to plot it.
Yeah.
So
just one quick announcement. So Philip is only here for the rest of today. So if anybody wants to speak to him, they need to speak to him between 30 and 5.
Yeah.
So we'll get cookies, coffee, and cookies.
And wine later.
And wine at 5. Yeah.